To the sermon. So Mark Twain, an author I dearly love, is credited with having said, he probably didn't say it, but that's okay. He is credited with having said, "Most people are bothered by those passages of scripture they do not understand. But the passages that bother me are those I do understand." Now, whether Mark Twain said this or not, I agree wholeheartedly. Passages of scripture that I don't understand or that are open to multiple interpretations offer hours of enjoyable thinking and talking and imagining. Any implications for how I actually live or what I believe are necessarily sort of tentative. And given the lack of real clarity often offered by these scripture passages, I feel free to draw on other sources to guide my decision-making. Popular wisdom, tradition, political theory, how I feel that day. Passages of scripture that I don't understand are intellectually stimulating and practically non-threatening. Consider today's gospel. You are the salt of the earth, a light to the world. We can play with those metaphors for hours. All the many ways to think about salt and light and our identity as followers of Christ. And then when we were finished with that, we could move on to Jesus' declaration that anyone who teaches anyone to disobey even the smallest bit of the law is in serious trouble. And we could talk about the ways that Jesus did, or maybe didn't, condone breaking the law, and the ways that Paul and Peter did, or maybe didn't, change the rules in the years after Jesus' death. We could spend some quality time on just who were the scribes and the Pharisees in Jesus' day to Matthew's community, and how might we be able, or not able, to be more righteous than they are. It's an incredibly rich text, rife with possible meanings and directions and significance for our lives. And although at the end we might reach some general conclusions about what it means, some possible insights, we would have to acknowledge that we can't really understand it, not finally, not fully. Passages I do understand, on the other hand, confront me with hard truths, usually about things like justice and wealth and power. They say things like, "Is not this the fast that I choose? To loose the bonds of injustice, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free and to break every yoke." That's pretty clear, really. God sent Isaiah to the people to tell them that if they were serious about looking for God, about knowing God present and active in their midst, they had to take care of the poor now and transform their society in order to free the oppressed once and for all. And although we can still talk and talk and talk, elaborating on the historical context of this section of Isaiah, and analyzing those if-then statements in the light of the doctrine of grace, we would, if we were being honest, have to admit that we do really understand it. We might just wish that we didn't. I rather wish that I didn't, because then I wouldn't have to admit how badly I, as an individual, and we, as a church community, as a city, a province, a nation, as the world, how badly we have failed to act on it. Like the Israelites newly returned from exile, we look around ourselves and we wonder at God's apparent absence. Isn't God supposed to be here? Isn't God supposed to be making everything better? Isn't that the promise? Well, not quite, as it turns out. God is not to be reached through fasting and pretty words and penitence. God is to be reached in feeding the hungry, bringing the homeless into our own homes, organizing to oppose unjust structures, and ending our own exploitation of other people. Because that is where God is. God's presence is not a reward for doing this work, and God's absence is not a punishment for not doing this work. It's simply the natural consequence of God being God, and so being with those in need. I want you to know that I preach these texts with a great deal of caution, well aware of the awesome degree of hypocrisy that I voluntarily take on every time I do so. Standing here and telling you to give more, to fight more, to take a hungry person to lunch or a homeless person to your house, to give up your comfortable, resource-heavy, privileged lifestyles, when I know just how little I myself manage to do. But I also can't very well not preach this text. These uncomfortable and challenging truths need to be heard and acknowledged by you and also by me. So know that I am preaching to myself this morning, more even than on most mornings, which is saying quite a lot. We know what this scripture is calling for. We may not know the best way to accomplish everything it is calling for, though some of it is pretty straightforward, and we complicate it for our own reasons. We understand it nonetheless. Real worship, real experiences of God's presence, real relationship with God is found in joining in the work of God. That's the promise. Not that God is just going to make everything right, but that we will find God when we work to make everything right. And when we do, when we are truly with God in that work, with God who is in that work, when we have given up our self-interest and our false worship in favor of transformed lives that is the fast God chooses, well, then our light will shine in the darkness and our saltiness will give flavor to the earth. I'm not there yet. Sometimes I get close. In my own small ways, I keep a door cracked open onto that way of life. A discipline of charitable giving, human conversations with people too often ignored, the occasional letter or march of protest, fair trade coffee, free-range eggs, feminist parenting. But it's such a tiny crack. And it is so easily blown shut by laziness or carelessness or greediness. And I know that God calls for more. God calls us to loose the bonds of injustice, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free and to break every yoke, to share our bread with the hungry, and bring the homeless poor into our houses, when we see the naked to cover them, and not to hide ourselves from our own kin. And let us remember, everyone is our own kin. It is particularly good, I think, to be wrestling with this scripture on this first Sunday of Black History Month. A month that is needed because the lives and experiences and contributions of Black people and communities have been systematically ignored and distorted due to the evils of racism and colonialism. And that is true not only out there in the world, but it is also true of the church. It's a truth that our national and diocesan churches are beginning to address through advocacy and training opportunities. And in fact, John is training to be part of the diocesan anti-racism training program, so we will benefit from his learning in the months to come. These are the bonds we are called to loose, bonds that limit everyone, regardless of race, bonds that impact even our own parish life, even if we can't quite say how, bonds that impact even our own souls. There is a lot of unlearning to do, a kind of learning that can only happen when white folks like me start listening carefully and with open hearts to what black folks and other people of color have to tell us and to teach us about the world, about their own lives, and about the gospel. It's not easy. None of this work is easy. Neither the work of listening and learning, nor the work of teaching. But it is work where God is to be found. And so the judgment of Isaiah weighs heavily on us, prodding us to take our desire for God seriously enough to actually go where God can be found. But it's not just judgment, it's promise too. The promise that we will find God in that work, because it is God's work. It is not our work, in that it is not all up to us. It is not our world we are building, but it is our privilege and our joy to join with God in the work. And once we do, we are promised that our light will break forth like the dawn, and our healing will spring up quickly. How could it not, when we are in the very presence of God?